Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
It has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on a big step!
Lead Toledo, Ernest. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason Mann. With me always is Rich Craich. And we are joined today by Philip Rossman-Reich. He is the editor of Orlando Magic Daily, as well as a contributor to Harvard Paroxysm, which is where you can find this very podcast. So, Philip, welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Glad to finally be on. Talk some basketball history here.
Yeah. So we are continuing our top 50 project, looking at the greatest players of NBA history, going through modern players and considering their cases. And today we are going to discuss Chris Webber, looking at sort of the overall numbers for him. He is 125th all time in win shares, 173rd in win shares per 48, 31st in box score plus minus, 34th in value over replacement player. For some of the all-time rankings, he is 72nd on the Bill Simmons pyramid, and he is 80th in the Slam 500. He has one All-NBA first team, three All-NBA second teams, and one third team. He has one season top 10 win shares per 48, two seasons value of replacement player, and six seasons top 10 blocks per plus minus. It's interesting. He does not rate very well in the win shares categories, but he rates very well in the box per plus minus value of replacement categories, which isn't that uncommon, but I'm not sure if I've ever quite seen this level of disparity.
It's a weird discrepancy. Yeah, usually you don't see that usually. Usually you'll get some guys more than not, like the box score plus minus will rate them a little bit better than the win shares versus the other way around, or they pretty well are in line. But yeah, Weber's a rarity where he's pretty much across, very, very, very different across the board. So it's interesting. Yeah, I might have to go deeper into that when we get closer to making that decision about the top 50, if Weber does come up again. Because yeah, it's very curious.
Yeah, definitely. So, Philip, what do you think about Chris Webber's top 50 case?
Webber came up, I think, in this era, at least he was in his prime during this era where there was all these great power forwards. I remember, watching him go up against Dirk, watching him go up against Duncan, watching him go up against Garnett. They're all in this conference too. And so I think most of us would probably say those guys are all top 50 caliber players. When I look at Weber's candidacy, I say, okay, so how does he match up to his contemporaries? And it's hard not to say he doesn't stand pretty tall against them. Those were all marquee matchups in the NBA throughout the early 2000s. Those are the matchups that you circled on the calendar for the national TV games. They were in the playoffs constantly. And maybe Weber was a little bit older than some of those guys, so maybe their primes didn't completely match up. But Weber did seem to put his best basketball on against those guys, but at the same time, his team seemed to be better than he was. Like when I think of those guys, I think that they were better individually, and maybe that's just because Weber did more for his team because he was. I think he was just a much better passer than a lot of those guys outside of maybe Duncan and what he was asked to do for his team. So, I think he certainly I certainly think he's in the argument, but. When I look at him compared to his contemporaries, I kind of wonder, was he a product of the team that he was on, or was he really that much better than the guys around him in his day and age?
I think, Phil, it's a good point. Right now, we always do this for the podcast. Sure. We look at kind of the stats, the advanced stats for error position and position all time. And it does kind of echo what you were sort of saying. If we look at error position, third in points per 36, 26th in rebounds per 36, third, remarkably, in assists per 36, 38th in effective field goal percentage, 16th in win shares per 48, fourth in win shares, and then second in value over replacement players. So that's in his era. So basically, like you said, he stands out from a point standpoint, not a rebound standpoint, but the assists, I think, is one of the biggest things, and it's exactly what you mentioned. I mean, he stands out as, you know, one of the best power forward passers of his era. When we look at all time, same deal. 11th in points per 36, 107th in rebounds per 36. So that's where he really suffers, is the rebounds. But on the other hand, 7th in assists per 36, 75th in effective field goal percentage, 33rd in win shares per 48, 23rd in win shares, and then 5th in value over replacement player. So again, value over replacement player really likes him. Great assist numbers, great scoring numbers. But, you know, the rebounding and that sort of stuff, maybe not quite there. He's an interesting one. I think the biggest thing for me is, and I get a very similar, like, a T-Mac vibe from him as well. Because if we were doing a top 50 of, like, guy, like, talent or whatever, he's obviously, like, you know, in his early days and pre, you know, knee injury, just a insane blend of, like, size and speed and just what he could do and how he could run the floor and just how he could just do so many things. But what was also interesting, too, is he was very nimble around the basket. Like, if there was an open lane, he'd just throw it down on guys and be ferocious. But if there was a guy in front of him, he'd be very, like, you know, very precise footwork, very, you know, kind of head fakes and that sort of stuff to get his position and to score. So it's interesting. But then, yeah, you obviously, a lot of the injuries robbed, you know, the last half of his career. And I think that's what really suffers for him, is when you look at him all time and you look at some of his numbers and you look at how we think of him and you look at, you know, like you said, contemporaries, he just doesn't have that longevity. It's like that especially those Sixers and the Detroit era, you know, he was still putting up 20 a game, but like he was in quicksand. He couldn't move. And then he just fell off like real, real fast. I mean, the Warriors years are just like pathetic. And a lot of the Detroit, you know, Pistons years, those were just kind of there. But I think that's where he suffers for me more than anything, is just that he doesn't have that longevity. Like he right when he was figuring out, you know, injuries kind of robbed him, and then he just wasn't the same again. So talent wise, yeah, he probably is a top 50. If you go by performance and what he sort of achieved, I don't know. It's a tough case.
Yeah, and it did take him a little while early to get going, although the numbers were certainly there. But he, or you know, for the most part, I mean, he produced still pretty well. But once he really made his way into Sacramento is really when he became like a star level, you know, just, you know, remained a star player. But that was a relatively short period of time. So, you know, he kind of produced okay on some middling teams, you know, kind of had some conflict with coaches and some just early stuff. So that actual like those prime years in Sacramento were, you know, he had, you know, four really good years before that knee injury basically, you know, kind of made him a shell of himself, unfortunately. And, you know, one thing for me is that I remember that certainly the passing and certainly many of the skills, but I'd forgotten like what like an incredible dunker he was and an incredible finisher he was like around the basket. I mean, he was really and the way that he could, you know, handle the ball and I mean, he was really versatile, and I remember that a bit, but just seeing the highlights just like brought that back. It's just like what a, you know, how much of a, you know, just all the skills that he had. And the other negative that I would say for him, and it may not be fair, but he did have a reputation for shrinking in big moments. I remember there's a Bill Simmons column, it may have even been part of his book, looking at Weber and looking at you know, some of the probably the 2002 series where, like, you know, he didn't really necessarily want to have much to do with having the ball like in the fourth quarter and, you know, in the big moments there. And it's not necessarily fair because, you know, he delivered at some points in big moments too, but that's just probably something that knocks him down, at least in terms of perception.
Was he the one that batted the ball out to Ori? I know that's not a measure of anything.
I think that was Divac. I believe that was Vlade. I'm almost positive, but I don't recall exactly. I'd have to.
I thought it was Stojakovic for some reason, but either way, it was a kick.
I mean, to that point, almost that series came to define everyone on those Kings teams. Like that was their moment. You know, we obviously if you win that series, you win a championship. You talk about Weber in a much different light. You know, you remember a lot of the things that he did, and but really he's just become the footnote in maybe Shaquille O'Neal's story, or the footnote in someone else's story almost, because you know he was either the kind of established old guard that Dirk had to get through, or he was the guy, he was the young guy or the youngish guy that tried to derail Shaq and Kobe. And so, you know, I don't know if you guys are looking this at this, you know, purely from a statistical standpoint, but I think that's kind of part of his narrative too, is like you said, like he kind of shrunk in those big moments, you know, when he had that big moment to really shine and be the guy. And I think a lot of people who remember that series between the Kings and the Lakers really believed that that Kings team was going to beat the Lakers. I mean, they were right there, you know, 7-game series, obviously game six was semi-controversial in a lot of ways, but they really were right there at the doorstep. And once that opportunity passed him, the knee injuries struck, and Weber was never really at that stage again. And I think that affects how we view him, because because then Dirk came on and he couldn't get, and Dirk got past him, and you know, and Garnett got past him, you know, 1 year too, I think. And so it really, once that door shut, it was shut.
And I think one of the interesting things is you look at when the injury happened as well, and you look at that 2002-2003 Sacramento Kings team, which a lot of people forget. That was a really good team. They came back that next year. Weber was playing out of his mind that year. They were, I think they had the number 2 seed, I believe, in the playoffs. They blew through the Utah Jazz. They were doing well against the Mavericks. And then, you know, Weber has that knee injury. They're done. They can't do anything. And then he comes back, and he's not nearly a fat. And the team, it was over after that. Like, once he goes down in that series, it's pretty well done. And it's pretty well, you know, that's it for the Kings. So it's interesting to sort of think of, hey, and of course, you know, we can't, you know, kind of fantasy or come up with fantasies of what would have happened. Hey, if he didn't get hurt, they might have won a championship. You know, obviously can't do that because he did get hurt. But you look at that year, and I always look at that year of like, man, I really wish we could have just seen another year of the healthy Weber. And then if they get to the same thing, say they face the Lakers or they face the Spurs or whoever they were going to face in the next round, if they do that, then if he still fails, then it's like, okay, you know what? This is the year that everybody sort of, because it was a little fluky the year before. I mean, they had kind of established themselves for a few years, but it was like, oh my God, these Kings kind of came out of nowhere, where I felt like that 2002-2003 year was like, okay, we're ready to go. I know Weber always says, hey, the minute that Lakers series was over, I got in the gym, I was ready to go. And he had a spectacular year in that 2002-2003, and then the injury happens and it's all over. So it's interesting to think of what could kind of happen, A, with those Kings teams, and A, with Weber's career and his legacy, if he stays healthy through those playoffs and maybe makes an NBA Finals. I mean, maybe not wins a championship, maybe not go that far, but at least makes it to the NBA Finals. I think you have a whole different trajectory and a whole different thought about Chris Webber at that point.
Yeah, one thing I would say, you know, kind of on a different end of things, is you know, he was part of a team, you know, under Rick Adelman, you know, using the Princeton system with, you know, Webber being a great passer, Divot being a great passer, you know, Jason Williams doing these dynamic things, and then later, you know, Mike Bibby, not quite as exciting, but, you know, still part of the team, obviously important. You know, good shooters, good passers, just a really beautiful style of basketball to watch. And, you know, kind of from that aesthetic standpoint, and maybe even a little bit in just kind of a style influence standpoint, I think Weber, there's something there that I think kind of boosts him, you know, just being just a beautiful guy to watch play basketball.
Yeah, I mean, I always enjoyed, I seemed like, you know, I grew up on the East Coast. You know, I'm from Orlando, obviously, which is another interesting wrinkle to Weber's history as well. But it seemed like everyone that followed the NBA that didn't have a vested interest elsewhere in the Western Conference or at the top of the Western Conference was either like team Rick Adelman's Kings or team Don Nelson's Mavericks. I
was both. Is that allowed?
I think so, until they faced each other. But like, anytime the Kings and the Mavericks faced each other, it was just like these two really, especially in that era when there was a lot of kind of me first basketball going on, when the Mavericks and the Kings faced each other, it was just kind of this like pure form of basketball being displayed on the court. And they were always a must-watch team. And certainly I don't think the stats bear this out too, with how highly ranked Weber was and everything that he did for them. And, you know, I think the wins above replacement and box plus minus really shows that probably too. Weber made that team work because he was such an unselfish player, such a skilled passer. And when you gave him an inch, he'd take it and score on you. I mean, he really did have the complete package. You know, he didn't have to be the great rebounder because DeVos was able to take care of some of that in a lot of ways. You know, he was a pretty good defender for his position as well. And so, he really fit that style perfectly. He needed to find a good fit. It didn't work out with him. You know, he had to kind of get over some of his, you know, I don't know exactly what the word is, some of his hang-ups on being in Sacramento. I think he really thirsted for a bigger market in some ways, but once he kind of realized that Adelman's system was going to highlight his skills the best, and the fact that they were winning also probably helps a little bit. Once he kind of came to that realization, you really saw him begin to flourish and become the player everyone imagined he was going to be when, you know, he was with the Fab Five at Michigan.
Do you think any of his legacy is hurt by how many times he was traded, and especially being traded so early in his career, a number of times, and then later in his career just kind of bouncing around as well? We always sort of think of him immediately as a Sacramento King, but as Jason said at the top of this, I mean, that was really not a big part of his career. I mean, he had – it's the biggest part that we remember, but he had, I mean, equal amount of length in numerous different spots. So it's interesting how he doesn't really have a home base, and we've sort of seen throughout this Top 50 project that those sort of guys that seem to bounce around and don't seem to have a home base or a team that they're sort of directly aligned with have an issue with legacy. Like, we don't really kind of regard them quite as high.
I think it's a little bit different for him because I think, like, he played definitely by far the most important player time in his career with Sacramento. I don't think there's really like a competing team. Like, he played a good while in Washington too, but no one really remembers those teams other than, you know, like, they were maybe like an up and coming team, like a what could have been kind of team. But beyond that, they didn't really do much. And then his other stops were actually relatively brief. So, he was with Iverson on the 76ers for a little while, but that when that kind of tore apart, and his other stops were pretty brief. So, I do think that there's like you. In general, though, I do agree that you're better off if you can stick in your career to pretty much one place. And if you're, you know, if you're on multiple teams, it does still kind of like put, for most guys, it puts a little bit of a stain. Why couldn't you have stuck in one place, or why didn't, you know, like, you know, and, you know, he certainly caused some personality conflicts or had personality conflicts with the guys that led to some of those trades. So it wasn't just like, but like, he did nothing. But at the same time, you know, it's a little bit unfair. Sometimes just things don't work out. And obviously, when he got the chance, he delivered on an incredible level.
Honestly, I think the fact that he bounced around the league a little bit definitely hurts his legacy some. Maybe, you know, and this is no offense to the good people of Sacramento and the Kings franchise and what they built in the early 2000s. But being in Sacramento may hurt his legacy too, just because Sacramento's, you know, kind of this out of the way market, you know, very, it's the smallest market in the NBA. There's not a lot of history there. I mean, he is pretty much, him and Mitch Richmond are pretty much the history of the Sacramento Kings. And, you know, ever since Weber left, they've been kind of an organization of dysfunction. And so I think Oscar Robertson's, you know, same franchise more or less, but Oscar Robertson's maybe a little less so because he has, you know, the statistical seasons that he had and, you know, a lot of people consider him a great guard, but he isn't kind of universally celebrated in maybe the way he should because Cincinnati no longer has an NBA team. And, you know, he really spent the latter part of his career in Milwaukee. In some of the same way, you know, no one care. I mean, again, no offense to Kings fans. I love Kings fans. They're the best. They're one of the best in the league. But nationally, the Kings don't move the needle. And so he almost to get the recognition that, you know, maybe his career merits, he needed to get to a finals or win a championship or at least challenge the Lakers multiple years, be, you know, like a bigger part of that main story that we tell about the NBA. And, you know, I think the other thing that maybe drags down Weber's career a little bit is the fact that there was so much controversy around his college career. I don't think that ever left him, that, you know, the Fab Five, A, never won the national championship at Michigan, and B, had all their wins wiped out. I mean, I know we're talking maybe about NBA stuff, but, you know, Weber, trouble seemed to follow Weber around, especially in the early part of his career. And, you know, for whatever overtones you want to put into, you know, how Weber acted and what he did while he was at Michigan. And there's certainly a lot that could be written about that as well. You know, people view that how they view that, you know, rightly or wrongly. And that definitely affected how, you know, we tell his story.
I looked at the video. It is Divock that that volleyballs the ball back to Robert Horry. So he is the man in question. So they're all there. It could have been any of them. I mean, they're all basically right by the ball.
It's the JFK tape of the NBA.
Right. Exactly. Right. Right. Yeah.
So anything else you guys wanted to talk about? All right.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Richard.
For me, Weber. I have a tough time with top 50, and I really do love Chris Weber, and I thought he has all the skill and all the talent and whatnot to do it. It's just that back end of his career is just not there, and like you said, the beginning is not quite there either. It took him a little while to get going, and once he got going, he was there for a while, and then it just sort of falls off, and the way it fell off was so spectacular. I mean, those Golden State, Detroit years are just like, ugh. Like, you're watching him play, and you're like, who is this guy? Like, he can't move. He can't do anything. Like, still could score because he still had the skill, but it's just all that was lost. Everything that was Chris Weber about Chris Weber was gone, and it really does hurt. So for me, that's kind of why I would probably put him in the not, you know, I would have him outside of the top 50, even though you could, I think, make a reasonable argument for him, but I don't know if the longevity there and the full career is there for Weber, unfortunately.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, I do think that the fact that he rates so well in the box score plus minus value replacement metrics, I think it's worth it to kind of a deeper look. But yeah, overall, I do think he's gonna fall short.
Yeah, I agree. I think the longevity is my big issue with him. You know, he obviously had a lot of very, very good years, just not a lot of very, very good years at the very, very top, which is, I think, you know, when you're talking about top 50, that's where you need to be.
Definitely. So, Philip, thanks so much for joining us, and where can everyone find you on Twitter and such?
The best place to find me is at @omagicdaily.
All right. Well, thanks again. And thanks, everyone, for checking us out. You can find us at harvardparoxysm.com. And we are on iTunes, both the Harvard Paroxysm Network and our podcast, Over and Back. We would love if you would give either or both a rating and a review. Let people know that it's great. That helps spread the word. And you can find our forums at overandbacknba.com. And you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at overandbacknba. So until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.